just the mic.
Louder. Closer.
Let's
better.
Move.
Stronger. Better. All right. So thanks to everybody for being here. Second Wind for fitting me in for the thesis reading of this year. And special thanks to Judy Blunt, Deborah Early, and Jeff Bull for agreeing to committee my thesis to big help. And hopefully if there are any, I'll leave a couple seconds for questions at the end so I can tell you about the true genre, nonfiction. I got my pun in there, true. So, I'm rereading an excerpt of an essay from my thesis. The thesis is titled Variant Definitions, Essays and Ruminations, and the essay that I'm reading from is titled Hitched. So due to time restraints, I'm going to be reading basically the second half of this. What you need to know to catch up to speed is that it's about the road trip out here from North Carolina. We make it to Missouri. I'm with my girlfriend of 3 months, moving out to Missoula to move in together. And in Missouri, about halfway through Missouri, her car breaks down. It's completely wrecked. Has to be towed to like St. Joseph, and it turns out we need to get a hitch put into my Jeep, which is named Sheba. So Sheba is my Jeep. She's beautiful. And her car breaks down, we need to get a hitch. And the person at the U-Haul putting on the hitch has stripped a bolt in the frame that is essential for putting in the hitch. And yeah, and so we need to get it fixed to move on, basically. So the next day, we're at a truck, trailer, and hitch spot trying to get this bolt out so that we can get a hitch put on, get a trailer, keep driving. The mechanic said, look, you get that bolt out, we'll get you on the way to Montana. I was stranded in flyover country, yes, but everyone seemed ready to help. I was dealing with people, not their jobs, which was something coming from the East Coast. We'll be back, I said. The Firestone in Independence was less help. I told someone the story. He said, there's one guy who could do it, but he's not in today. He recommended Streeters and left us to our fate. The GPS took Sheba to a decrepit warehouse of a building, lost to time as the city sprawled around it. Looking at the facade, I felt lost on an Appalachian back road. I'm not sure the parking lot was paved. Without a word, Kaylee jumped from Sheba and walked to the door. What are you doing? I said. Whatever I can. She disappeared behind a rusting apothecary door, the glass opaque in yellowed newsprint. I entered the nearest garage into the GPS, then went after Kaylee. There wasn't a light on in the place. Every window was blocked in the same newspaper. Shelves rose to the ceiling and dust covered every surface. It looked like the inside of a barn. I passed the supply closet and disconnected toilet bowl. Junk and rusted car parts hung from the rafters and littered the floor. A car frame raised on cinder blocks sat by an open garage door from whence the only daylight entered. Kaylee talked to a kid with long, stringy blonde hair, like he was going for Kurt Cobain but stopped at House of a Thousand Corpses. He was polishing something with a blackened rag, listening to the end of Kaylee's story. I grabbed her arm, tried tensing it toward the door. She stood fast. Honestly, I don't know, the boy said. You'd have to ask my dad, and he's going to pick up my brother. Thanks anyways, I said. How long will he be? Kaylee said. Half hour? Outside, I said, pick him up from where? Jail? I'm not leaving my car in there. I passed the next garage 3 times before finding it on an intersection corner. I walked in and told my story. Until that bolt was gone, we could not budge. The mechanic was big, bearded. He smiled like a bear, like something soft. He said he'd take a look as soon as he could. Time and again, those we beseeched went out of their way to help. I'd waited for hours to get my oil changed. Every time, I expect to hear some $300 grommet needed replacing. I handed the bear my keys, and Sheba was in the air a moment later. I walked toward a group of men huddled by the rear. Jesus Christ, they sure did a hack job with this one, didn't they? The bear said. Yeah, it's a complete mess. Is there anything you can do? I'll take a blowtorch to it, but if that doesn't work, then nothing will. The heat will make it rock hard. Well, okay then. Go for it, I guess. Thanks. I imagined a torch under Shiva. If it loosened the bolt, what could it do to the frame? Would she be forever weakened? Brittle? Kaylee waited in the office. This is it, I said. This is the last shot. A silence fell. I paced, sat, held Kaylee's hand. It was like we were outside the delivery room. The birth took a turn cesarean needed. Sheba was family, and I relied wholly upon her. She was scarred, beat up, and torched. She deserved a bath, but I believed in her. She wouldn't let me down, not like Kaylee's cruiser, her PT cruiser. A mechanic opened the door and motioned us out without a word. No, I followed. Kaylee followed. The bear looked at me, then dropped a quarter-inch hulk of metal to the ground. It didn't even look like a bolt, just a piece. Is that it? I said. That's it. Done for as soon as the torch came near it. My God, thank you. I thanked everyone there. I shook the bear's hand and went to pay. The office was silent, save the mechanic punching away at a calculator. He paused, looked up. $15, he said. And I was waiting for at least one more zero in that number. I fired up Shiva, scared that she needed that small piece of metal to make it back to truck, trailer, and hitch. You think those guys were fucking with us? Kaylee said. Oh God, yeah, I said. Shiva got hitched, and Kaylee found a trailer in Cameron, outside of St. Joseph. 10 miles outside of Cameron, construction left the road I took with one operating lane. A portable traffic light shone red at a hillcrest. All roads are straight in Missouri, and not car nor worker existed along the block stretch. Should you just go? Said Kaylee. Not after this morning, I said. Ages passed, but nothing else. I inched forward in an attempt to trigger some imaginary switch, but daren't try the stretch head on, only to total Shiva over the next blind rise. Cameron was maybe 4 blocks of a town, smaller than quaint, but with the affection the word implies. And the GPS directed us into a gravel lot behind his and hers sport gallery, a single trailer tilted into scattered rock nearby. A buzzer mounted under a fading neighborhood U-Haul dealer sign looked broken. It worked, but I still felt the impulse to back away from the door, the town, the entire state. The gallery owner was a congenial man and led me into the back of his shop, which served as a tuxedo outfitter and cell phone retailer, in addition to stocking jerseys and Letterman jackets. I signed the paperwork, declined at the same insurance every rental agreement pushes, and followed the man out back, chuckling and skimming through the previous 2 days. This is a problem, he said. Shiva had her hitch, sure, but no ball or pintle to connect the trailer. And I just thought my rig was different than what I saw on most Dodge or Ford trucks. I drove an SUV, not a flatbed, so of course my hitch should be different as well. Give me a second, said the gallery owner, and disappeared back into the shop. One single ball mount waited on some forlorn shelf gathering dust. I bought this off someone for $20, he said, back in the heat. If you can give me what I put into it, the thing is yours. After $500, hours, and energy spent prepping Shiva, the 20 flew from my wallet and we returned to St. Joseph. Dragging the empty trailer was an exercise in unease. The box met Shiba in height, decals stuck to each wheel well, warning to keep the trailer under 65 miles per hour. I cut the speed in half to control the hulk of empty space. The connection thundered at every bump, rattling Shiba's rear. I doubt Kaylee could feel a thing, but I gripped the wheel, pretending it steadied the shuddering car frame. We pulled into St. Joseph Firestone by noon. It was over 100 degrees, and I could carry what Kaylee could not, the heavy and cumbersome. Kaylee focused on the smaller, yet equally taxing objects. I emptied a portion of Shiva's trunk into the trailer, piling box after Rubbermaid after box of books into the trailer's rear. I wanted to start an argument with the decal instructing me to load 60% of weight in front half. Bungee cords stretched from wall to wall, locking our lives in place. Mechanics in Firestone glanced our way from time to time. The female coordinator approached Kaylee, saying, well, it looks like everything worked out. She was smiling. Kaylee tried smiling. She was out of breath and told a shortened version of our story. After I closed the trailer and Kaylee emptied the cruiser of everything she could think of, loose change, jumper cables, the cruiser was cleaner than it had been in years. I felt dirtier than even summer camp could have managed, those weeks of lakes and swamps and showers that only half cleaned. Though there were no fallen pine needles to hide the smell. I wanted to cover the car seats. I wanted to wrap them in plastic, but that would have only made it worse. There was nothing to do but roll down the windows and kick up the air conditioning. Sweat cooled, stuck, and we drove north. Northern Missouri flooded. After an hour or two, the highway began to look like a bridge between Florida Keys, a road on a sandbar. I thought of ignoring the signage directing me toward an off-ramp. No, this is the road I want to be on, not that one. Can we just keep going? I said. The GPS couldn't figure out what we had done. It wanted us to turn around. I was supposed to be on 29 North, enter Kansas for a few miles, and drive through Omaha. The detour led through cornfields and wind turbines. Rolling hills tested my comfort dragging the trailer. The road was paved in 6-foot concrete slabs. Seams rocked the joint, keeping our trailer in tow, clicking, lifting Sheba's rear. It felt like I was being lifted, jerked by a hook through my spine. I slowed. Cars and trucks began a caravan. Kaylee studied an atlas. Soon the detour markers ended, and I relied on Kaylee's reassurances that I was still following the path. Sedans and commercial trucks passed amid scarce oncoming traffic. The detour lasted 300 miles, and still the flooding persisted. I didn't know how half a state could be submerged in this heat. It's as if the humidity condensed the landscape existing between states of matter. I planned to make up time, make it into South Dakota, but gave in at Sioux City, south even of Sioux Falls, where I meant to be 30 hours prior. We were still in the red, and I accepted that I would not be catching the ghost of what I thought the trip would be. But we left Missouri, that was the important part. The city was surrounded with stagnating water from the flooded Missouri River. Neighboring roads and towns were lined with sandbags. Kaylee informed her mother of our decision to camp. So the drive was peppered with text messages warning of bears, Rocky Mountain fever, and other calamities. One message read, "It's all fun and games until someone gets bit." It was dark by the time I pulled into the camp. My headlights shone upon a screen of mosquitoes. They sounded like rain on the windshield. We passed one lonely tent among RVs and tiki torches at 11 p.m., then frantically set up a tent, swatting and ducking through swarms. A single swing of the arm brushed swaths of the bugs. I was swimming in them, kicking tent stakes into the grass against sting after sting. A group of geriatrics sat by a picnic table yards away. We set up our camp by the light of their torches, which kept the mosquitoes from their sight, but directed to ours. Their conversation lulled as we jumped from the car, stopped completely after a few minutes. The tent made it up, sans rain shield. We jumped back in the car, smacked at the few insects that got in while the doors were open. We needed food, spray, a flashlight, and something to mix with rum. Inside the tent, I counted 30 bites. Kaylee counted 6. It was more humid than hot, enlivening the accumulated stick and old sweat. A comforter served as mattress. It clung. I may have been overzealous in using the bug spray, essentially fumigating the tent. I pulled out the rum, and Kaylee lit a cigarette, called me Skeeter Butt for the rest of the night. "But what if I have to pee?" Kaylee said. "You are not leaving this tent." South Dakota involved 8 hours of one straight road. I think a single fence lined the highway for the whole state. I was driving over a foreign planet. Poet Louise Erdrich described the region as an agribusiness moonscape. I couldn't imagine any business taking place there. I filled the gas tank that morning, but worried still whether Sheba would make it between stations. The first ancient billboards for wall drug started appearing, boasting free ice water, 5-cent coffee since 1931, when the town worked to survive on the Badlands outskirts. Snakes, dinosaurs, and roosters shouted kitsch from hundreds of miles away. "Don't miss wall drug, something to crow about." The strategy was a vague belligerence. No sign explained what the town held in store for travelers, so the mystery amplified intrigue. Kaylee checked in with her mother, which resulted in the trip's longest stretch of silence. I overheard her say, "You should see how many mosquito bites John has. There were so many, and they swarmed him." I started waving my free arm, screaming without sound, mouthing, "What the hell are you doing?" Kaylee couldn't understand why I was trying to shut her up, then spent the next 15 minutes reassuring her mother that no, I did not have West Nile virus. No, I was not going to a hospital. Kaylee hung up and I started a fight. A lifetime of movies depicting men groaning over mother-in-laws crystallized in my mind. A new level of understanding sunk in. On top of that, I was learning what relationship squabbles were. In that moment, I knew I would never win another argument. The trick at that point was to exit the conversation with as little bruising as possible. At the same time, I felt like a cliche and accepted into an unspoken masculine brotherhood. A running joke handed down from my father's college years popped into my head. Women, you can't live with them, and you can't live with them. Smirking under my breath, so to speak, was the wrong move. Kaylee pleaded for me to stop at the Corn Palace, a warehouse coated in crop art. "I live in a world of no," said Kaylee. We did pull off the highway to eat at Owl's Oasis, thinking it an authentic truck stop diner sporting wooded Western-type facades. The heart was a lie. Inside, the storefronts gave way to a series of connected shops selling magnets and shot glasses, a grocery and cafeteria-like restaurant. We left without eating, looking for that diner with the homemade pie and waitress named Rose that surely existed over the next rise. 5 hours passed. The mileage to Wall Drug dwindled and started to look feasible, though I was forced to skip the Petrified Gardens. Wall Drug evoked a Disney-like aesthetic, as if a copy of a copy of an imagined Wild West, with a full-size plastered jackalope in the rear courtyard. Not even full-size, like two-story jackalope. And I had reached a point too hungry to make a destination on, or a decision on where to eat. It was difficult to even find where people ate. I ended up pushing instant mashed potatoes around a paper plate. I knew what a tourist was. I'd spent time in Europe trying to blend in and avoid pulling out a map. Traveling meant wandering, trying to see a place as the natives did. The trick was to pretend you lived there until you left. The tourist traps of North America are something entirely different. These pit stops exist for their own sake, hollow leeches enticing children to badger weary fathers from the back of many minivans. In these places, the tourist was the native, the natives the staff. We almost detoured into the Badlands, but images of soft shoulders and crumbling sedimentary rock kept us to the interstate. Sheba could make the trek, no doubt, but I couldn't stop thinking of the trailer tilting, falling, pulling. Mount Rushmore was too far south, as was Yellowstone. Kaylee vetoed Deadwood after seeing scantily clad women beckon from billboards. Internet searches on contemporary Deadwood showed the place to have lost its soul to Disneyification, a copy of a movie about a time that never existed. I pulled into the Spearfish campground on South Dakota's Wyoming border with hours of cool light remaining. The tent went up. I collected firewood from the camp store and saw Crow Peak Brewing Company from across the street. I returned to Kaylee. "You'll never guess what I found," I said. There was a moment in every move I've made. Once I pulled, put away my clothes, moved the couch, and plugged in the television that I stopped and sighed. "Home," I said. "I have to. It's a bullet point. A moment in which I close my eyes to redefine the word." Kaylee was a type of home. The tent, another. Sheba was more of a base or a cockpit, but a home nevertheless. The border to Montana, waiting 2 hours away from Spearfish and through the northeastern corner of Wyoming, was another door to another home through 9 states. The morning felt good. I even handed my car keys to Kaylee for the first time since we met. By night's end, the U-Haul would be returned and an apartment filled. Before entering the expanse of eastern Montana, I glanced to the gas gauge. This was just beyond the last town where wilderness reigned. Or before wilderness reigned. A train track lined the road, but civilization was in the rearview mirror. "Did you need to stop for gas?" I asked. We decided against the gamble through pushing to the next rest stop, which would have been 20 minutes along the East Coast interstate of our childhood's 95. But this road into Montana looked quite different. I think the telephone wires even stopped at some point. Kaylee needed to U-turn in a car that was not her own, pulling a trailer for the first time. She cut the road in half and stopped. A trail of cars crested a hill in the distance, approaching at speeds above 70 miles per hour. "This is bad," I said. "This is really bad." Kaylee kept quiet, inching from shoulder to shoulder. "You want me to do it?" I said. "Yes." I was back in Sheba's control, cut the wheel right to coax the trailer left, then straightened her out back in the direction we came. There's no way we could have reached the next gas station, which was hours and hours away. Kaylee took back the wheel, and I let my eyes close. Mountains loomed in the distance, the entire landscape painted in goldenrod. Steep inclines kicked Sheba between gears. I cringed from the passenger seat every time the engine revved. After a few hours of this, Kaylee stopped for gas and handed me the keys. I knew my car. I could work the transmission like it were manual. I apologized somewhere around Butte. "I didn't say anything," Kaylee said. "Yeah, but you were right. The engine could take it. I knew the engine could take it, but I still felt the trailer's weight as if carrying it." Sheba screamed. I patted her dash and apologized to her as well.